The Biological Jew, by Eustace Mullins, Part 7. Geopoliticians have said for years that America was running down. Everything that our nation has achieved had been done at the cost of tremendous outpourings of energy and instinctive intelligence. There has been much native greed and cruelty also, the merciless gouging of immigrant workers, the mass slaughters of the Civil War, and the systematic destruction of America's only native culture, the Greek revival gentility of the South. These are dark chapters in America's history, but there are also bright pages, when America lived up to all of her promise of freedom and her offerings of hope to a sick and rotted European civilization, which was slowly expiring because of the excesses committed against her by the Jewish parasites. And now it is America's turn to totter on the brink of the abyss as her economy reels from the onslaught of revolutionary mobs at home and insane Jewish adventures abroad. But there are still some scientists who are blazing new trails for the world. Perhaps 1% of the nation remains constructive in the face of all these disasters. In 1957, I could not predict the burning of American cities while police and National Guardsmen stood by under orders to show every possible courtesy to the rioters. I could not predict that a Jew who had thrice been denied security clearance would commit large-scale American troops to Vietnam in order to sabotage our national economy, an effort which was advertised as an effort to stop communism, while the CIA planned the execution of the nation's anti-communist leader, Ngo Diem. No wonder his widow remarked to television newsmen, quote, "With America as a friend, you don't need any enemies," close quote. The $300 billion effort to stop communism in Vietnam would be more believable if it had not been inaugurated by the same lifelong dedicated Marxists in the State Department who had sabotaged Chiang Kai-shek's government and turned China over to the communists. Can we really believe that these traitors, who had presented the communist world with a gift of 600 million people, were now prepared to make an all-out effort to save a few Vietnamese from the same fate? They showed their hand by refusing Chiang Kai-shek's offer to send troops to Vietnam, just as they had refused his offer to send troops to Korea, because the State Department planners had to stick to their plan of showing Asia that it was white imperialists who were preventing the Vietnamese from peacefully setting up a communist state. If Asians were sent to fight communism, the Marxists in Washington would lose an important plank in their program to wreck our nation. Meanwhile, at home, as the gross national product reached new highs, due principally to runaway inflation, the Marxists continued their mad looting of the United States Treasury. Typical was the establishment of more than 100 think factories in which the Jewish parasites drew huge salaries for sitting around, thinking up new ways to exploit the Gentile host. We find Herman Kahn's Hudson Institute exposed in The Nation, May 13, 1968, as having been reviewed by the General Accounting Office, and its $1 million a year contract proved to have produced nothing of value. The General Accounting Office characterized the work of the Hudson Institute as its ideas a rehash, superficial and valueless. The Nation noted that virtually no records were kept, either at the Hudson Institute or by the General Accounting Office, as to how money was spent, the progress of programs and other usual business procedures. We find that there are some 100 similar concerns in this country, offshoots of the RAND Institute, which spend an average of $50,000 per man per year. This is a salary of $1,000 a week for a Jew to sit in an office puffing a cigar, a type of boondoggle, which was inspired by Mortimer Adler's $20 million windfall from the Ford Foundation to study philosophy, with the usual valueless rehash of superficial ideas as the only tangible result. These monies come from tax-exempt foundations or from government agencies, principally the Department of Defense, and never a word of criticism from our senators and representatives who dare not criticize this method of the Jewish parasites exploiting of the Gentile host. The rapid deterioration of America from a position of strength to a rank of second-class power, racked at home by riots and bankruptcy, is a classical example of the effect which the Jewish parasite has upon its Gentile host. Writing in the Washington Post on April the 5th, 1968, Drew Pearson exposed Walt Rostow as a man who committed troops on a large scale to Vietnam. Rostow is a Jew whose father is an avowed socialist, and Rostow himself, after being refused security clearance 3 times, was placed in charge of our national security. The man who refused him security clearance because of his background is a loyal American named Otto Otepka, who has undergone continuous persecution ever since. State Department files were destroyed, witnesses were bribed, and perjury was committed to prevent Rostow from becoming another Dreyfus, a Jew who had gained admittance to the nation's top security councils and who was now to be rejected because of his past. Later, as director of our national security, Walt Rostow and a little group of high-ranking government Jews gathered in the Pentagon early one morning to cheer the Israeli sneak attack on its neighbors and toasted each other while Israeli planes massacred American soldiers on the USS Liberty in neutral waters. The riots, which have devastated American cities for 3 years and left entire sections in smoking ruins, remarkably akin to the destruction which Jewish-directed bombers had visited upon the cities of France and Germany a few years ago, had their initial inspiration in the writings of a little black hustler in a pamphlet called The Fire Next Time. It was published in a house organ of the Jewish Parasites, the New Yorker magazine, and later issued as a book. In this work, James Baldwin promised that the Negroes would burn down America's cities. Baldwin has long been familiar as a housebroken pet of the Jewish Parasites, and he lived for 2 decades on the liberal outpourings which they gave him from various tax-exempt foundations. Some grants were made in return for his favours, others were made to encourage his revolutionary activities, but none of these awards could be said to have been a sincere appreciation of his feeble literary talent. Since the fire started, he has prudently remained in Paris, snickering at a series of gay parties on the left bank, while America's cities are devastated by the black mobs who consider him their inspiration. In his interviews, which are always prominently displayed in the New York Times, he refers to the United States as the Fourth Reich. It's an in-joke among the parasites. If James Baldwin gave an intellectual impetus to the riots, the actual planning was done by the Chinese communists. The inside story of the burning of Washington is that the Chinese communists devised a plan whereby the city of Washington would become a free city, divorced from the United States and administered by a Black Power Commission. This commission would then charge the United States $10 million a year rent for the United States Capitol, the White House, and other government buildings. While Mayor Washington approached President Lyndon Johnson with this idea, he was told that it was out of the question. A few days later, the city of Washington was on fire. The stage had been set 3 days earlier at a communist cell meeting at which the party leaders decided upon the death of Dr. Martin Luther King, a North Vietnamese professional. Noi Thi Gan was flown in for the job, while an American Oswald, or Patsy, as his name has now entered the American language, was murdered and his body buried that same night. At this Communist Party meeting, one of the conspirators, a member of Mayor Washington's staff, mentioned that our soul brother, Walter, had guaranteed the safety of looters and arsonists during the forthcoming burning of Washington. Not a shot would be fired against them. This was the commitment. The promise was kept. During 3 days of looting and burning Washington, not a single rioter was injured by the thousands of police and soldiers who stood by with orders not to fire. Mayor Washington stated at the beginning of the riot that any policeman who shot at a rioter would be charged with murder. He fought bitterly against the ordering out of the National Guard and permitted it only after extracting the incredible commitment from the National Guard commander that the troops would keep their weapons unloaded and that they would be permitted to load and fire only after obtaining written permission from a superior officer. This was the most ridiculous order ever issued to troops going into a combat situation. These conditions were then read over television stations WTOP and WTTG in Washington so that the rioters would know that they could loot and burn without a shot being fired against them.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
At the height of the burning, on Friday evening, after the communists had murdered Dr. Martin Luther King, according to plan, President Lyndon Johnson called Mayor Washington and begged him to allow the National Guard to come in. Mayor Washington curtly refused and hung up on him, so great was the arrogance of the Negro leader. The following afternoon, when most of Washington was in flames, Mayor Washington permitted the National Guard to come in, but only to protect the looters, because some of the Washington City Police, who had been shot at and clubbed by the rioters, were threatening to fight back. The merchants cheered the arrival of the National Guard because they supposed that this meant a stop to the looting and the burning, but they were dumbfounded to see the soldiers standing by while Negroes drove Cadillacs from Newark and Philadelphia up to their stores, loaded color televisions, the most expensive clothing and other loot into their cars and drove away, while the soldiers did nothing to stop them. When the stores had been looted, they were set on fire, and again the soldiers did nothing. At 3:15 p.m. on Saturday afternoon, Mayor Washington had the instructions to the National Guard read over television stations WTOP and WTTG. He assured the looters that 1. The soldiers were carrying unloaded weapons and that they would be allowed to load and fire only after being given written permission from a superior officer. And 2. That the soldiers and police had been ordered to show every possible courtesy to the looters. With this reassurance, the rioters stepped up their activity, and the riot spread to Baltimore, where the same conditions were in effect. Mayor Washington's instructions resulted in another wild night of looting and burning. 558 buildings were burned to the ground in the city of Washington after being looted at a cost of $80 million worth of goods stolen and $10 million in property damage. As one rioter explained when interviewed by a television cameraman while he had his arms filled with hundreds of dollars worth of expensive clothing, "Man, it's wonderful. They can't bother us because we've got a soul brother up there." During the height of the rioting, WTTG newsman Hal Walker, a Negro who was allowed to move freely about the city during the riots, interviewed a Jewish merchant, John Heschinger, who is chairman of Washington's city council. "Don't you see a pattern to this looting?" asked Walker. "Oh no, it's indiscriminate," replied Heschinger. "But aren't only certain types of stores being burned?" pursued Walker. "No," muttered Heschinger, and the interview was suddenly cut off the air. Hal Walker was referring to the map which had been prepared before the riot in Washington, on which every Jewish store was marked, and of which 300 copies were distributed in the city on the morning before Martin Luther King was murdered. The Chinese communists had persuaded the black power leaders to stage a massive anti-Semitic uprising against the Jewish merchants who had exploited them. The main target of the burning was the destruction of credit records, and this goal was achieved. Now Heschinger and other Jewish merchants began a frantic campaign to conceal the nature of the anti-Jewish uprising. One Washington merchant, Irv Weinstein, refused to go along with the cover-up, and he openly declared that the burning of Washington was the biggest anti-Jewish uprising anywhere in the world since the end of World War II. He pointed out that the heinous Kristallnacht in Germany during the Nazi regime in 1938, in which Jewish stores were wrecked, had only resulted in a total of $100,000 damage, while the Washington uprising had cost Jews $100 million. Against the wishes of his fellow Jews, who were desperately trying to cover up the story, Irv Weinstein tried to present a petition to the United Nations charging Mayor Washington and the city council with genocide because they had encouraged the Negroes to attack Jewish stores and had refused the Jews the protection of the city police and the National Guard. Ambassador Arthur Goldberg, our representative to the United Nations, refused to accept the petition and assured Irv Weinstein that the United States government would make good every dollar lost by the Jewish merchants. When he returned to Washington, Irv Weinstein was visited by two black power leaders who told him he had 3 days to live. 48 hours later, he disappeared and has not been heard of since. Meanwhile, other Jewish merchants who reopened their stores in Washington were visited daily by black power leaders who charged them 10% of their gross to stay in business, a tactic they had picked up from the mafia. One Jewish liquor dealer who refused them, Ben Brown, was shot down in cold blood in his store, and Mayor Washington still refused the merchants protection. Meanwhile, other Negroes were murdering bus drivers each evening, which caused the bus drivers to go on a slowdown. The purpose of these tactics, to wreck the economic life of the city and its transportation system, had been planned by Chinese communist leaders in order to paralyze the Vietnam peace talks. They correctly reasoned that with our capital city in flames and its economic life shattered, we would lose face and would be unable to make a strong presentation at the Paris peace talks. The murder of Dr. Martin Luther King had been timed for this purpose. Meanwhile, agents of the Central Intelligence Agency were discovered to have also played a part in fomenting the Washington riot. When their role was revealed, CIA officials stated that the burned buildings followed exactly a plan for a Washington expressway through the city, which had been proposed for more than 20 years, but which could not be implemented because of the cost of acquiring the business buildings and tearing them down. Now that they had been burned out, the expressway could be built at a reasonable cost. The riots, which devastated American cities, represented a new stage of the Mongolization program, which the Jewish parasites had devised to weaken the United States. And if Jews, such as Irv Weinstein, seemed to be the losers in this new phase, it was because they refused to look at the long-term program, which had been devised for America by the Chinese communists and their tools, the Black Power militants. This program had been forced upon America during the Second World War, when the people were living under martial law and had to accept, without protest, each new dictatorial decree of the federal government. At the end of the war, the Chinese communist program moved rapidly to implement a forced Mongolization program along three fronts. 1. Force integration of all army units to prevent the existence of any armed unit such as an elite white guard which could battle against communism at home. 2. Forced integration of schools to educate children from their tenderest years to meekly accept government integration decrees. 3. Forced integration of churches, private clubs, and neighborhoods to prevent any adult white Americans from having a place where they could meet to discuss possible reactions against the activities of the Jewish parasites. During the campaign for forced integration of all American army units, the Chinese communists found that there was a shortage of Negroes in the armed services, and they began a hasty program to attract more Negroes into the army. One of these attempts was a poster which was widely distributed in Negro business and residential areas and prominently displayed in Negro taverns and barbershops. The poster read, "Young Negro men, are you victims of race prejudice? Do white girls refuse to go home with you? As a United States soldier, you can travel abroad and be stationed in the homelands of our allies, where your high pay will make you wealthy in the eyes of the people. Your money is worth 5 times as much as theirs. Negro Americans, the white girls of Germany and England, are waiting eagerly to see your healthy smiles. Join the United States Army today." This plan came to an abrupt halt when copies of the poster were sent to Europe, where a press campaign was inaugurated to stop the planned debauching of white European girls by black soldiers, a favourite goal of the communists, which began shortly after World War I, when detachments of black Senegalese troops from the French army were stationed in Germany and given orders to rape as many German girls as possible. The federal government withdrew all copies of the poster and destroyed them. A European newspaper offered $1,000 for a copy, but none could be found. One tactic of the communists had backfired.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on The Daily Stormer.